you've got to align with like-minded people who have done this, who for you, it's brand new and scary, but for them, it's Tuesday. You got to really watch your assumptions. So that's the two things I would say is get yourself a mentor and really check your assumptions, because a lot of people don't even realize they're making these assumptions. Try not to be a master of all trades or a jack of all trades and try to do every single thing. That is just silly. Pick one, maybe two things. Go really hard and really understand that really well and hire everything else out. You're going to pay no matter what. If you're in development, you're going to pay no matter what. And it's a matter of how much time, money, effort, lot, sleep, blood, sweat, tears. You're going to pay in some way. You might as well hire an expert that'll do it the fastest and has the most experience and has a great portfolio of other people they can call. Action by inaction is still an action. Educate yourself every day. Listen to a podcast. Pick one, even mine. It doesn't matter, but pick one. There's lots of good ones. And learn the words, learn the phrases, become comfortable with being uncomfortable. Because if you are in development, you're in real estate, you're in business of any kind, awkward conversations are going to emerge.
So today we have got someone on the mic who's worn more hats than a sounding board on espresso. Honestly, Jennifer Salisbury, a Navy veteran, a cross-border real estate investor, an actual doctor of education, and get this, she's been working on a condo development in Mau. Jennifer, welcome to the show. Do you go by Dr. Jen? Jennifer, how do we call you?
I'm only Dr. Jen in the podcast. So just Jen is fine, Eugene. That's great.
All right.
Nobody
awesome.
Cares.
Welcome. And so I got to ask you and be honest, at any point during those 27 years, did you ever think to just burn the place down?
Multiple times. I just said, can we please just forget this? Can we please just walk away, lick our wounds, tail tuck between our legs and just call it good? Can we please do that? And my husband said, nope, we got to burn the boats. We got to do this. And so, okay, well, we did it. Yeah. But
nice.
Learning how to do development without losing your temper, especially when you're exhausted, you're exasperated, and the person that you're talking to is the person who's causing the headache, but they're also the person that can fix it. I know you can relate.
Multiple times, I truly had that feeling walking out of the city hall that I just want to burn that place down and punch some of these in the face. Like, I got so angry. But I mean, that is the reason. The reason it takes so long and the reason development is unpredictable is why I stopped caring about IRR metric, how internal rate of return. How do you treat it? How do you explain it to investors? What do you measure when you figure out your projections?
Well, here's what's funny is when we were talking about development and just moving through the development, especially when we had already pulled building permit and we were actually in the build, stopped measuring, we would do progress complete. And we ended up building 8 fourplexes in South Maui. And we completed everything and got occupancy about a month before Lahaina burned. So we were completely done by the time that happened. But so what I would measure is, have we got a stop work? Has anybody stopped us from doing this? Like insurance, permits, neighbors, lawsuit, insurance claims, any of that? And so are we still able to keep going? Is the answer yes. Do we still have employees showing up every day? Primarily, our skilled laborers and our really incredible gifted folks. Are they showing up? Are they on time? Are they sober? That's always another issue too, right? Of course, yep. And then the biggest thing is that in a day, you feel like you get nothing done. But in a week, you look back and you go, oh my gosh, look what I did. In a month, you go back, or I would do the next draw request for the mortgage loan. And I would look back and go, oh my goodness, we're almost ready to do this on this building or to do this on this building. And that it was more practical than a calculation when I would track things.
Did you have investors on that deal or was it all funded internally?
So no, we did not syndicate that one. We had partners, Okay. But we didn't syndicate it. But Michael was the general contractor. I was the construction manager and it was a true mom and pop. Like we were there every day for 3 years and we lived 45 minutes away, which was a blessing and curse because we could swing by Lowe's and Home Depot and all of the supply parts stores that we needed on our way and then our way back. So no, we didn't syndicate it. We still had all the inspectors, all of the subcontractors, all the partners. And so every Friday I sent out an email. It was a 3-week look ahead. an email because we didn't have a Zoom meeting or anything. Remember, we started this build in the middle of COVID because construction was an essential service. And so we couldn't have meetings, like in-person meetings. We had to have, you know, just updates. And so I started this email chain of, it ended up being like 60 or 70 people every Friday would get this huge long email from me. And basically what it was is, here's where we are in building one. Here's where we are in building two. Here's where we are in the pool. Here's where we are in paving, landscaping, and just went through the whole thing and go, this is the next step. And so, you know, the HVAC guy could go, oh, okay, I need to plan to do building six next week and, you know, charge building seven and things like that. And so he could plan out more based on actual events and weather, right? It is Maui. And so, I mean, just 2 days ago, we had a tsunami warning. That's the reality, is because we're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And so we would get windstorms, we would get deluge rains, we would have to completely stop. And there were a couple times where we had to send everybody home because it just wasn't safe to keep people here. Yeah. So measurements, practicality.
I thought Maui was paradise. Nothing ever happens there.
Yeah, it is paradise if you're on vacation. And that's the way it's been designed. When you are there, you're not on vacation, you're working. Prices are high. You know, a gallon of milk is $12, $13 a gallon. Trying to go out to eat. I mean, and the service industry is struggling because, remember, with Lahaina burning down, all of the messaging was, don't go to Maui, Maui's closed. And what ended up happening was the rest of Maui was starving for customers. Nobody was going. Everybody's like, oh no, I can't go there. They told me not to go there. Oprah and The Rock told me not to go there. And all of us saw this going, oh my gosh, this is going to be an implosion. So there's been absolutely a shift in tourism. The tourists are now starting to come back and realizing that the rest of the island is thriving. We're still trying to do more, but, you know, there's worker shortages. There's all kinds of other things. Maui is paradise. It is paradise. The views are incredible.
Of course. I'm often asked by the beginners when they're in the beginning of their development path is, how do they finance the early stages? So they've got the land. Let's assume land is debt-free. They want to go and develop it, whatever they're developing, infill house, townhomes, apartments, whatever it is. The first question is, do I need to go and raise money? Do I partner with a developer who comes in with millions of dollars? Or do I borrow? What's the first step? And the answer I usually give them is, it is fairly risky to borrow against the land to go through the development cycle, partially because you don't know how long it takes. But it's also sometimes the easiest money to get. It's hard to go out and syndicate it and bring outside investors because you don't have a project yet. You don't have plans, you don't have designs, you don't have pro formas, you don't have permits. But and how do you calculate your projections? Your investors want to know how long it's going to take and how much they're going to make. In the very beginning, you don't know. How do you approach that? And what advice would you give?
Well, it's interesting because I'm actually doing exactly what you just said in Canada right now. We are developing 5 acres as affordable housing that's been given, but it's designed for 48 rental pads where we can put tiny homes or people can bring their own homes or their RVs or whatever and rent them long term. But how did we get into this? Basically, we had to leverage our assets in Canada. And we had a great working relationship with both our credit union and the local bank that we work with here, and had some very frank conversations of, are we financially strong enough that we can actually do this? And it's a tough lift. We're about 30% into this build, and there's been curveballs thrown at us where it's like, right now, my septic tanks are too close to somebody's well. And so we got to move our septic tanks 10 feet. Like, that's reality. Did my contractor mess it up? Was the survey off? Like, what happened? And at the end of the day, some days it's like, it doesn't matter what happened. We still have to fix it. And thank God we're fixing it now instead of when we have 48 people living there and the road is paved and things like that. But back to your question, how would I go to finance it? You've got to be really strategic on what is it that you're trying to build? What's the cost of the build? And your assumptions. You're saying, I'm assuming that the cost of construction today is going to be the same cost of construction when I order in 5, 6, 7 months, right? Who knows if that's actually going to be the cost of lumber, especially now we still have tariffs, you know? You're assuming that your mortgage, your cost of money is going to be whatever percentage and the loan points are going to be whatever percentage. Same thing with your pro forma. You're assuming that whatever you're going to do with the end result, whether it's a townhome or tiny home park or whatever it might be, you can only make a best guess based on like unit. and say, okay, I think I'm going to get $800 for this pad rental based on this other place that's similar, not identical, but similar to us and the product that we're offering and the tenant avatar that's going to stay, right? And so you've got to really watch your assumptions. But everybody in the development phase, I think, they are so optimistic. They will budget for what they want it to be. So they will budget not enough time and not enough money. And it will take longer and cost more than you think. And you don't want to get to the end of that and go, okay, I didn't get enough money, because you can't rent. Even if you get to 95%, you can't rent that. If you don't have occupancy, you can't rent it, right? And so how do you actually lend to it? You've got to check your assumptions. You've got, honestly, the best thing is, and I think you and I've talked about this before when you were on my podcast, you've got to have a mentor to help educate you in what you're actually doing. So if you're a newbie in development and you're actually going to start a new construction by yourself, you've got to align with like-minded people who have done this, who for you, it's brand new and scary, but for them, it's Tuesday. That's what you got to do. And that's exactly, you know, if someone's new about this, it's not just about the money. It's about the experience. It's about the entire risk profile of whatever you're about to do. Remember, there's a lot of places in North America and globally that are now oversupplied. And so you've got to also assume that the demand for whatever product you're bringing on the market in whatever time is going to still be in demand or even have a higher demand. You're assuming that when you put your pro formas together. And so you've got to really check all this, because if there's a 500 unit apartment complex or townhome subdivision that's coming online now and you're trying to start developing it, you may have an absorption rate where you can go ahead and build, but your townhomes may sit there for a long time empty because they're not getting absorbed as fast because the market is oversupplied. You got to really watch your assumptions. So that's the two things I would say, is get yourself a mentor and really check your assumptions, because a lot of people don't even realize they're making these assumptions.
Definitely check your assumptions. I'm curious though, when you're building a model, and the traditional approach that I've always been taught for many years is that you have to work with the data that you have today. When you're building a model, use your today's sales or rental comps, use your today construction cost assumptions, and then you can build forward-looking projections, but it has to pencil with today's dollars. Now, everybody understands that by the time you actually go to build it, it's going to be tomorrow's dollars, and by the time you deliver it, it's going to be a day after tomorrow's dollars, but you have to make sure that the model works today. What I see very common that especially beginners assume is that, okay, well, here's my cost to build it today based on what my contractor said. Here's what I see the market sells at. If it's a for sale product or rents at, my model doesn't pencil because cost is more expensive than the value is. But I know the real estate appreciates. And so I'm going to assume that by the time I'm done, it's going to sell for 10% more. And if I now put 10% more, a higher price in my model today, then everything works. I'm happy. We're good. Let's move forward. Is that a right approach?
I had a contractor tell me once, he says, I'm going to give you a price today. And then when you're ready to pull building permits, I'm going to give you a price that I'm going to reprice it, right? So you can't just start just because a deal might work, and it might work at the end, and it might work with appreciation, and it might. Remember, these are all your assumptions you're figuring out. Some of them are going to be right. Some of them are going to be really wrong. Even that with your contractor is making assumptions as well when they give you that bid. Is there a contingency in there? If there's not, you need to add at least 10%. If it's new construction, I'd add 20%, because guess what? If you get into it and you have to move something, or there's a code change or a bylaw change or something, guess what? The contractor doesn't eat that. The bill goes back to the developer. The developer has that. And so not only it's costing more money, labor, now you got to pay, you've paid somebody to do whatever it is, then you got to pay them to undo it, and then you got to pay them to redo it. You pay them three times. So no, you can't just add 10%. I wish it was that easy. It's not.
Right. I usually say, look, if the deal pencils in today's dollars, then it's got good potential tomorrow. Obviously, you have to carry contingency. Usually, a good contractor would tell you to budget, or they would budget themselves, at least a 5% escalation.
At least.
Increases. I mean, nobody canceled inflation. Even in the lowest inflation periods of years past, construction costs would still go up. And so carry that escalation. And then on the revenue side, always assume a reduction.
Always.
Prices might stay as is. Prices might go up. And if they do, great, everybody wins. But what happens when they go down? What's your contingency plan? Never forget that contingency plan. Can you refinance? Can you hold it? Can you exit without losing your money or your investors' money? That's always the key thing to watch for. You mentioned something else before when you talked about the septic being too close to the water well. Mistakes happen all the time. And when my team comes to me with a problem, I usually say this. The problem is what I need to know. How do we fix it? Who effed up? Because I need to know who's going to pay for it.
Right.
Is that the right approach? Or do we just assume that we as owners, developers have to take care of everything and fix all the problems ourselves and pay for them?
We like to have a conversation. So first of all, when things happen, because they're always going to happen, we always give each other 90 seconds to be as mad as we want to be. That's a Tony Robbins trick, right? Be as mad as you want to be, and you cannot make a rational decision when you're mad. Like, you just can't. So be mad, throw a fit, whatever. 90 seconds are up. Tap dance on 89 seconds. 90 seconds are up. Okay, speak in fact. This happened, this happened, this happened. The fix is this. And then have a conversation with whoever effed up, whatever. Have a conversation and just say, what's your plan to fix this? And let's work something out. Contractors and subcontractors carry an enormous amount of insurance because of this kind of stuff. I don't necessarily want to see people make an insurance claim, but contractors build buffers into it. Why? We're contractors too. Like, we do the same thing going, we know that at some point somebody's going to mess something up and we're going to pay them to do it, pay them to undo it, and then pay them to redo it. And we're not sending the owner the bill. There is flush fund in there. And so I always ask whoever it was that messed up and say, what do you propose we do about this? How do we make this right? What do you propose? And let them come up with a solution, because chances are they've already been stewing about it and panicking about it. Right? They're, you know, maybe even expected to get yelled at, which doesn't help, quite frankly. Losing your temper does not help. And so if they come up and say, we can do this and we can do this, but I can't do the materials. If you can get the materials, I'll do the labor, something. Or, you know, they say, I'm going to make an insurance claim and we're going to do this and this and this. But again, zoom out from whatever solution they're saying. How does that affect your critical path? How does that affect the end line? Because if you have to now reorder materials, and let's say those materials are 2 weeks out, that's going to delay everything, but maybe that's the only option, right? It's not just who effed up. It's not just the solution. We have to move the septic tanks. Well, guess what? My big excavator, the one that moves the septic tanks, has now blown a head gasket. So now I'm in a panic trying to get parts to fix the excavator or rent another excavator and bring it in, because I cannot delay. We've got consultants coming in. We've got inspectors coming in. We cannot wait. And so this is where the resourcefulness of being an entrepreneur comes in. You've got to figure out how to do this. If you throw enough love, money, and resourcefulness at any problem, you can fix it. And so it's not just about being mad or placing blame. You still have to fix it and move on.
So in this particular example, how did you figure out who's going to end up with it?
So that's a good question. What I had done was I had crafted an email to the engineer originally, thinking that the engineer placed the tank right in this. Long story short, there was a bit of survey creep. And so our guy's placing the tanks going, oh, I'm just going to move it a few feet because the driveway curves here. Oh, I'm just going to use it a few more feet because this tree needs to come. And so ended up that it was our guy that did it. So now I'm the one paying this bill. So I got to be careful, though. You don't want to burn bridges, right? You don't want to get mad and you don't want to get snarky. But at the same time, I can say, okay, guys, what do you want to do? And I know our project manager, our contractor that did, he called me and he owned it. He said, Jen, I did this. This is what happened. This is what it is. It wasn't the engineer. It wasn't this person. It was me. I did it. And here's how what happened. Here's what we're going to do to fix it. But I need a machine that works to fix it. Right? So I have the weekend to fix it. So yeah, that's how we're fixing it. And again, I'm just thankful that it happened now, because there's still dirt on the ground. There's nobody living there. There's no finished. Literally, we could move it, you know, all over the place because there's nothing there. Imagine in a year from now, if we'd have discovered this, or let's say the neighbor would have come up with a problem from our septic tanks, that would have been really awesome, because now I would have had a full operating tiny home park. That would have been way more painful. So in the grand scheme of things, we always try to fight the fires when they're really small, and we don't
wait. Exactly. Well, and it's super important to get these things detected early and fix them early, because the longer you wait, the longer you go. Or let's say you discovered the problem and decided to bury it, not bring it up, and then an inspector caught it at the final. That's the worst, because now you have to undo a lot of the work that's been done, and it's going to cost so much money. We had a crazy example when we built townhomes, and at the final inspection, this is it. Everything's done, finished, final cleaned, like literally the final inspection. The inspector comes through, walks into the master bedroom of these townhomes, looks around and says, these windows won't work. We're like, what do you mean? He goes, that window is too high to be an egress window. We're like, no, that's impossible. Yeah, it needs to be, I forget, I think it couldn't be taller than 4 feet off the ground, and it was just over that. There were like little square windows up top. And we're like, no, 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 this is the final inspection. You've inspected that at framing. You've inspected that in the city. You've reviewed the plans before we got the permit. The window supplier inspected all of the windows because they typically check on egress regulations. We're like, we can't fix it. This is the final. And he's like, sorry, code's code.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, I might have missed it, but this is the final inspection. I got to make sure this building is safe and this is life and safety. So fix it.
Get to it. When an inspector gives you a hit list, when you fail an inspection or you partially pass an inspection, it hurts. Be mad for 90 seconds. But they also give you a pathway to an approval. Like they tell you exactly what you have to do. You may not like it,
right. But
you know how to get the approval now. Now, how many windows did you have to fix? Probably more than one.
Four. One in each.
But not bad.
No, it definitely wasn't 400. That was a smaller project. I mean, it was complicated because the landscaping outside was all finished and we needed to bring a lift there to get there. So, you know, landscaping had to be fixed. The lift needed to be brought back in. The siding needed to be undone, redone. So drywall paint, new windows had to be ordered. Oh, and by the way, it's 6 week lead time to get a new window in.
What happened? Welcome to development.
Exactly. But that was one of the reasons why we decided to actually shut down our construction company and focus on development. When you own your own construction company, you take on a ton of other risks that a contractor assumes. And so when you're on both sides of the equation, you have to realize that this is the risk you have to assume. And yes, you do capture a little bit of a margin there. But in my case, I decided that it's not worth my time and my money to keep that margin. I'd rather pay it to somebody else. I would much rather them have that profit to also have that headache.
You know, Gigi, and that's very strategic, deciding pick one thing to be a specialist in. And for all your new listeners out there, try not to be a master of all trades or a jack of all trades and try to do every single thing. That is just silly. Pick one, maybe two things, go really hard and really understand that really well and hire everything else out, because let's face it, you're not going to like everything that is involved with this. Development is hard. Running permits is hard. Doing all the payables is hard. I mean, every bit of it is hard. And so if you can hire someone smarter, faster, better, cheaper than you or one of your companies, do it. It's all about the team. It is not about what you personally can do. It's about the team. Good choice.
Definitely all about the people. Exactly. And yeah, my goal was to focus on what I know best. And I hear it all the time. I recently spoke to a developer who's working on his first project and he says, I'm going to GC it myself. Have you ever done it before? No, I haven't. This is going to be more. What is the reason why you want to GC it yourself? The answer was, I want to make more money. I don't want to give up that profit margin. And I said, that's the absolute wrong motivation.
Correct.
You can have a million other reasons, but if you're only doing it for money, that is the wrong motivation. Because if you've never done it before, you're going to pay dearly for that lesson. Build a few with a GC that you trust, and then you could try to do it yourself.
Absolutely. You're going to pay no matter what. If you're in development, you're going to pay no matter what. And it's a matter of how much time, money, effort, lot, sleep, blood, sweat, tears. You're going to pay in some way. You might as well hire an expert that'll do it the fastest and has the most experience and has a great portfolio of other people they can call. If your GC is worth their weight, which they probably are if they have been experienced, they have a guy for every problem because they've encountered it. And so they know how to do it. That's what you're paying for. You're paying for speed, you're paying for experience, and you're paying for the network. It has nothing to do with money.
Exactly. So shifting gears a little bit, you've done work in the US, you've done work in Canada. How do you adapt to different geographies, different rules, regulations? Now you've got state, provinces, federal, local, municipality. How do you navigate that? What would be your advice?
Let's just talk geographic areas. I'm north of Vancouver in British Columbia, but I'm also in Hawaii. Both locations are traditionally challenged. Both locations have logistic problems. And so everything costs more. Everything takes more time to get where it's going, right? When materials. When we're talking permits, you've got the same layers as anyone, especially any of your listeners. So you've got your federal, your state or your provincial, your territory, wherever you are. And then you've got your regional district, parish, counties, whatever that may be, and then your municipalities. And if your municipalities have a building bylaw, most of them do, they will require a permit and then inspections. One of the things that we've done in Canada, there's a couple locations right near where we have our existing rentals in Canada that does not require building permits. Now, they still require safety inspections for health and safety. As we mentioned before, that doesn't go away. That will always be there. But there's no permit to build. So this is where we understand, what are the pain points? How can we do a different things that we want to do? How can we do new construction? We tried to do a tiny home community in the municipality. They, quite frankly, were not interested. Their zoning and their bylaws that didn't, it didn't pencil out. And to get a permit to do that would have been long, involved. The infrastructure is different. You've got to pay development cost charges, infrastructure charges, all kinds of things. And so it did not pencil out in today's dollars, which it was like, okay, so we got to change the factors. We got to change the assumption. Let's go outside the municipality. Let's go in the regional district and go, what are the changes? So the first thing I did, I happened to know the planner. And so I called her up, and I've known her for 15 years. I said, okay, here's the scenario. We want to build, we want to provide affordable housing. We want to do something like a mobile home park, RV park, something that we can provide rentals and rental pads for people to have this in-between housing. The tenant avatar is first-time renters, and then renters who are exiting after having been owners for a long time, right? So you've got people who are biologically young, people are potentially biologically older, and then you've got folks in between who are maybe only in the region for a short time, you know, 6 months, a year, whatever it might be. But it works, right? It creates a community. And so explained this to her and said, there's several parcels we're looking at in the different areas of the regional district. And I said, what's your take on this? And she says, well, we don't have a building bylaw. And so we have areas that we can recommend and that we're trying to put density and different things and things that we'd like to see. So we can help you, but we can't endorse you. Which, think of those words, Eugene. We can help you, but we can't endorse you. It's like in the city, it's like, no, you'll never get a permit for that. Okay, well, they're different words in that. And so that's one of the things we've done. In Hawaii, they don't have that kind of thing. Every single thing is regulated. There's it's layer on top of layer of different requirements for housing. There's a lot of people, quite frankly, who are bringing in homes and they're just straight up going without permits. It's so complicated, expensive, just super frustrating. And even, you know, Lahaina fire survivors, they're still leaving. They're still leaving the island. I mean, it's absolutely astounding. I actually have 14 tiny homes on Maui right now that I could set up, but I have no land to do it. And if I had the land, could I get septic? Could I get electric? Could I get water? Right? Those are the big three. Could I get those so that we could actually have them habitable? That's always the question. And that's where the county just sort of goes radio silent. And it's like, and they know it. I mean, I talk with the mayor's office quite often and they know we have these homes. I go, okay, you know, this is action by inaction is still in action. So anyway, that's kind of how we do it. But it's not necessarily country-based. It's location-based. There are locations in the U.S. that don't have building permits that you can do stuff like that I'm talking about. So it just depends on the level of bureaucracy of whatever you want to do and, you know, how long and how involved is whatever you want to build to get it.
Right. So obviously it took you on one of the projects many years to push it through. And I'm assuming mm-hmm. it all mostly had to do with the approval process and how bureaucratic it is. What would be your advice from your experience? What would be your advice for somebody who wants to develop something? Like, where do they start? Do they just walk into the city hall and introduce themselves? Or do they...
That's what I do. That's exactly what I do. My mom lives in San Antonio. We walked into city hall and I said, my husband and I are contractors in Hawaii and in Canada, and we are interested in potentially buying land and providing housing here. Who can we talk to? That's exactly what anybody that's interested, go into City Hall and say, who can I talk to about developing my land, assuming they're a landowner? You'd probably have to make an appointment to meet with a planner and then just say, based on the zoning, based on this, based on all these factors, what can I do with this property from their perspective? And then the next person I would call on is your insurance agent. I would call my insurance agent and say, what would it take for me to get insurance coverage to build this? And then once it's done, to actually have the coverage. And the insurance sometimes can be the biggest battle, because the insurance is going to say, okay, if you've never been a GC before and you're trying to GC this yourself, the insurance will require the experience. You know what I'm saying? So, right. But I would call the insurance agent next because they can be the next thing. And then I would talk next with whoever I'm banking with and just say, I had this conversation with City Hall. I had this conversation with my insurance agent. This is what we're thinking of doing. What would be a strategy, you know, according to whether it's your credit union or your bank, whichever. And it could be, you could get a line of credit. It could be a personal loan. You could get in together with friends, family, whatever, and do it together. Or you could capital raise and syndicate it. You could hire Eugene. You could hire, do a co-development deal on that kind of thing. But I would start at City Hall. If you're in a municipality and you require a permit, start there because you can do nothing without the permit.
Right, exactly. And unfortunately, a lot of municipalities are not very friendly because, not because they're bad people, but because frankly, they're busy. It is unfortunate reality of our lives is when city gets too busy, their natural reaction is to reject. By the way, most cities never reject a permit, in quotes. They would send it back for endless amounts of revisions. And it's never a giant stamp like you see in the movies or memes with a big reject sign that or denied. That never happens. It's just an endless loop of, well, we can't approve that because you need to do this, this, and that. But unfortunate reality is that when they're too busy and when they've got too many things going on, too many projects, and they're understaffed, their natural reaction is if your application is not 100% to their standards, whatever the standards are, codes and bylaws. Ordinances and whatever else, bylaws, yep. Exactly, then they would bounce it back for a revision. That's where the problem lies. And that's where the conversation is super helpful. Rather than writing letters, rather than hiring a lawyer, rather than trying to fight, always try to have a meeting and discuss it. You know what? Many municipalities have the review staff have counter hours, which means they are on rotation where they work at the counter. What we've done in the past when a reviewer does not return our phone calls or emails, we would look up their calendar, their counter calendar, and we would walk in when they are working the counter. And
they can't escape you.
They can't escape. And you have to come up to them and have a conversation. And you're not forcing them. You're not yelling at them. That never works, as you said. But you're moving the conversation forward.
Eugene, there's one other thing I want to give some advice to your listeners, especially if they're new at this. When you're trying to figure out if your deal pencils out in today's dollars, do not expect it to be for free. Right? You're going to have to get some input from either an architect, maybe an engineer, maybe a contractor, whatever. And if you're needing some help, let's say you're doing this and you have no money, be careful, because if you have no money now, you're already bootstrapping time and you're trying to be resourceful. And I get it. Problem is that sometimes the answer is hiring an architect for a consult for $500. And getting their expertise. Remember, you're getting their brain, their knowledge out and saying, look, does this make sense? If their answer is no, they just saved you a whole heap of trouble. But if they say no, if you do it this way, or maybe don't build townhomes, maybe build a fourplex or do this or do that. They've got great ideas. But again, the Greek to dollars ratio for them also has to work. So don't start right. Thinking that the whole thing is going to be for free. That's not reality.
Yeah, like saying that if you want free advice, the value of that advice is exactly what you paid for it.
So true.
Excellent.
But
all right, let's wrap up. We've been talking for almost 40 minutes now. In closing, wanted to ask you a couple more questions. For someone just starting with, say, a duplex or small infill, what mindset or habit would you gift them?
Educate yourself every day. Listen to a podcast. Pick one, even mine, it doesn't matter, but pick one. There's lots of good ones, and learn the words, learn the phrases, become comfortable with being uncomfortable. Because if you are in development, you're in real estate, you're in business of any kind, awkward conversations are going to emerge. So the more that you educate yourself, even for 10 or 15 minutes a day, it's amazing how much you can cram into a lesson if you can dedicate yourself for just a little bit every day. It adds up. So educate yourself. It's the number one thing I would say.
How would you define success? What would a success mean to you?
I think that depends on so success for me is defined very differently. Admittedly, I'm sitting on my boat anchored in Desolation Sound north of Vancouver. And we did this by design, right? And so that is my definition of success, where I'm working in the morning. We're working on several deals right now. And we've got another Zoom call here in 10 minutes with my contractor for another deal we're working on in the Midwest. But that's my definition of success. Waking up, I did not wake up to an alarm clock. I am having a great conversation, great coffee, great podcasts with folks like you. And I'm still working, and we'll be done by 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then we'll go play, right? And then we'll go play. And that's my, but by design, we have gone through, and by reading books like Think and Grow Rich, there's many others, we have figured out what really lights us up. And it's freedom of time, it's freedom of health, and it is really spending time with family, making memories. Money is a tool in that, I won't lie, but making memories, because the time aspect is what everybody thinks they have lots of, and you have no idea that the currency of time, you spend it without ever knowing what you have left. And so how do you define success? Individually.
Yeah, you have to figure out what success means to you, the listener, and it could mean many different things. Financial success is just only part of the equation. It's only one of the variables that you have to factor. If it means a miserable life while achieving it, then maybe that's not the right path. Jennifer, thank you very much. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, where can they find you, and what could they learn from you, or how they could contribute to your success?
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate it. So my podcast is called My Life as a Landlord. Website is mylifeasalandlord.com. I'm My Life as a Landlord on all podcast platforms. YouTube channel is at My Life as a Landlord. We are doing all kinds of real estate deals and starting a new YouTube channel about how we're working on our boat. If they want to contact me, you can do it through any social media channel or go to the website and send a note. Love interacting with folks. Yes.
Excellent. Yeah, we'll have all this contact in the show notes. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time and thanks for your useful advice.
This has been great.